yourself, Kurt.
Mae West, Mae West.
I'm Jimmy Hoffa. Okay, tonight's issue is capital punishment. Unfortunately, small canvas of the village, we're having difficulty finding people that are for capital punishment, but I'm sure, hopefully, tonight we will have some people here and you'll feel free to express your views. We'll start out just by having a couple comments to begin with to get us going. Probably my only goal or function here is to keep things above the belt and to keep things moving. So please address the issue and not necessarily the person, although at some points it might be appropriate to talk to the person that made a particular comment, but please also remember that we're dealing with an issue and we aren't trying to annihilate people here. So let's try to keep it as fair as possible so that everyone can express their views. I asked Mark to say a few comments. Mark is a pacifist, so he comes at capital punishment from probably a little different perspective than many of us do, so we'll begin with him.
Well, actually, what I thought I might do is throw out, I think, a couple options on the several different ways that you could approach opposition to capital punishment and then see if that would start a discussion. One is the pragmatic argument that you will hear many people making now, which is that it has become so expensive and so complicated with multiple appeals and the like that capital punishment has become cruel and unusual just because of the length, the expense, the complication, and the fact that given the length, expense, and complication, that some people have better defense than others. So there is a pragmatic argument. I don't know how much it took to kill Bundy, but it was
$6.5 million.
And every execution costs a very large amount of money because we have a built-in safeguard. So one is the pragmatic argument. Another is sort of what I would call the little literalist argument, which says, thou shalt not kill, or turn the other cheek. Arguments are taken from Scripture literally and are used explicitly in applied to capital punishment. The problem with that one is that there's lots in the Old Testament which argues the other way. My own position, the third one, is that I find it inconsistent with Christian witness. That is, if we are called to live out a life of love and service, I don't see how we can do that, live a life of love and service, and participate in the execution of people, even if we find their crimes horrendous. It seems inconsistent with a life of love, and that's the basis also of my pacifism in terms of the military. But it's less on a prohibition, I'm not saying thou shalt not kill. I think that sometimes killing, unfortunately, is necessary. For example, a policeman in hot pursuit in a very dangerous situation may have to kill someone. A society in cold blood may also feel that it's necessary to kill on occasion, but that I, as an individual, do not find that consistent with my own life as a Christian and love towards others. I guess one of the issues that people could argue about is whether our individual ethic should be binding on a society. Because if you followed my ethic, if the government attempted to follow my ethic, there are a lot of things that they couldn't do that they are doing now and that the overwhelming majority of people think the government should do.
Give an example of that, such as...
Well, I would unilaterally disarm, which most people wouldn't do.
Does anyone know, is the general population of the United States for capital punishment?
Yes, it is. It depends on how you frame the question. If you give them information about how much it costs or how long it takes, you'll get a different response than if you ask them simply, should a murderer, first-degree murderer be executed, or murder with rape or something like that. It's easy to say that if murder or rape, then the person should be executed. The problem always is how do you prove that the person is actually guilty? And that's one issue that often comes up. What happens if you execute people who are innocent? We have, I think, on occasion executed people who are innocent. So if you pose it, if the person has committed aggravated, say, murder and rape, something like that, or second offender, and it's proved beyond a reasonable doubt, should that person be executed, you'll get the majority of Americans in favor of it. If you say, shall we do that and spend $6.5 million for each one, and take 10 years to do it, you get a different answer. And sometimes the different answer is we should get rid of all the safeguards. That way they would be executed more quickly. But then you could be darn sure that you'll execute more people who are innocent. And then the other issue, of course, is that it's disproportionate. The number of blacks who are committed, convicted of felony first-degree murder and are sentenced to die to be executed is much higher than the number of whites. It's also a class issue, that the number of middle-class individuals who are executed is considerably smaller than the number of lower class.
That's where we get the phrase, those who don't have the capital get the punishment.
Right. And it's true. I mean, but the Supreme Court is, those arguments worked for a while, and now with the new justices, they're denying those arguments. It looked like by around 1973 that we would get rid of capital punishment entirely. And then they sort of backed off from it, and since then they've been backing off more and more.
I think if you're going to talk about popular opinion at all, and if you're going to say that the American people have, have some say, that society, I guess we'll say as a whole, has got to think about how they want to react to murderers, then I think you'd see after the Ted Bundy incident that I would bet capital punishment went up pretty high. And I mean, if you were taking daily polls, I'd have to think capital punishment went up a good 5 points after that, because here you have someone who's been in the news forever. And all these appeals, and we've all heard about his trials and stuff, and him maintaining his innocence. And then 2 days before he's executed, he comes out and admits to, I can't remember the number, but it was over 30, and I think it was closer to 50 or 60 murders over a period of years. And most of the ones that they suspected him of in Washington State and Florida, and I believe they even said there were a number that they hadn't even considered him a suspect for, I think in Idaho and a couple other places. People cheered when he was, the crowd outside cheered when he was executed. And I think somewhere you've got to look at, the mentality of society and say, here's somebody who got what he deserved. I mean, this was not a one-time killing. This was not somebody who got a little overpassionate at some, lost his temper and had, killed somebody and not thinking, here's somebody with a pattern who you really had a choice of either putting in jail for the rest of his life in order to protect society or killing. And I think you'd have a tough time convincing a lot of people that justice wasn't served in that case.
Well, it seems like what you're speaking of there, to a certain extent, is what is popular justice. And I kind of writhe a little bit in my seat when I think about, if we were to poll the society at any one time and say, what should the punishment be for the crime this year? to me that breeds a lot of inconsistency. I think it would be kind of interesting and maybe helpful to take a look at maybe what some of the history of capital punishment is, how it has been viewed in, say, democratic societies, how it's been viewed in other societies and democratic over the years. I must say that I'm completely ignorant on that fact, and if anybody has any knowledge of that, I'd be interested in hearing it.
Well, capital punishment was used for a wide variety of crimes into the 19th century. And then there was, in the first half of the 19th century, there was a movement in both Europe and in America towards penal reform, and penitentiaries had come into being at that point. It's part of the liberalism and the notion that education can accomplish certain things. It's strongly driven by religious groups. And a whole variety of crimes that used to be capital crimes are now treated by imprisonment. Mutilation and things like that, which were punishments, are done away with. And so there's a great narrowing, and there are a lot of people who think that by putting people into institutions, they can be rehabilitated. And this is an idea that's only about 200 years old and popular only for about 160 or 70. Up to that point, there was no thought of rehabilitation. People were just punished, and the punishments were very often capital. So that's in the West. I don't know anywhere else. But
we are one of the few developed countries, though, that even have capital.
Yeah. At this point, yes.
There are several nations, from my experience in Africa, there's still, it's quite common to, if you get pickpocketed and you yell thief, you've decided that person's going to die. You've got to decide if what's in your wallet's worth that person's life. Because a gang will form and pursue that person and kill them on the spot. And this is common in developed nations of Africa, Kenya, Tanzania, all through East Africa. I know for a fact that is a common occurrence if someone will yell thief, and a lot of innocent people are killed in that way.
One of the first acts of the Sandinista government in Nicaragua was to abolish the death penalty, and Nicaragua today has no capital punishment in their prison system is a reform system in which I don't think people stay longer in it than 20 or 30 years. It's a system that really works to reform its criminals.
Most East Bloc countries, though, do have capital punishment, including the Soviet Union. So it's not, most of the Western democracies don't. Most of the East Bloc do. And so we're in strange company.
I wasn't clear on that. You said Nicaragua does have capital punishment.
Does not.
No, it still does.
Well, one thing we could argue about, since we don't seem to disagree on much, is what about the deterrence argument? You know, that's often made, that this acts as a deterrent. Whether we like it or not, whether it accords with our principles or not, at least deters other people from committing certain crimes. And it probably wouldn't deter Bundy, but other people.
I don't think that's a very good argument, because most people who commit a crime have the idea that they're going to get away with it anyway. You know, like when I remember to my own personal experience, anytime I was thinking of disobeying some kind of rule, I never had the concept that I was going to get caught. So I always ignored what the potential punishment was.
Or do people, when they're going to commit a crime, rationally sit down and think, if I do this, I'm going to get 10 to 15, or if I do this, I'll get life. I don't think people rationally kind of sit down and however it occurs, if they have thought it through, so the deterrence seems to...
Well, I think there's something that, you know, I think we're looking at crimes from a perspective of kind of like an individual who goes out of control. For some reason, their thought process becomes irrational and they do something that's completely out of control. And I think we can kind of understand that that's oftentimes, I think, how we rationalize that crimes happen. You know, coming from Portland, where there's been a significant increase in crime over many years, over the last decade or so, and where there's been pretty strong evidence of the, quote, career criminal. If you look at the mentality of a career criminal, and that's been fairly well observed, these are very rational people. And crime to them is a business. And they are quite aware of deterrence. They know quite well, extraordinarily well, what they can and cannot get away with, not only in terms of punishment, but in terms of being in a system where there is oftentimes so little jail space that people who commit some fairly heavy-duty crimes will be bounced out on probation within a few days' time. So when we look at the idea of deterrence, I think we have to remember sometimes that the kind of mentality that we're dealing with is one that knows the system much better than we do. And so I think it behooves us to take a look at two things. First of all, do we really have a judicial system that is assigning punishment that is suited to the crime? And secondly, is that punishment really being carried out? Is it being carried out to term? Is it working? And is that punishment being applied in a timely manner? If you've got courts that are booked up for months, even years, these people are going to be out on probation. And in that time, it is highly likely that they will commit more crimes. Now, I realize that this deals with a lot more than just capital punishment. But I think when you look at deterrence, be aware of the career criminal mentality. And realize that what you're dealing with is something rather formidable.
I have to think that if you sped up those appeal processes, I mean, without doing away with our entire legal system, but you know, rather than having 25 different appeals to three different levels of courts and that sort of thing, you know, if you went to a standard criminal sort of appeal system where you've got three or four courts to go through and the whole process is going to take 9 months, that's like, if you're going to commit a capital crime, that's like holding a gun to somebody's head, and I gotta believe you're going to get somebody's attention. There may be some people that are still going to go out of control. You know, you're never going to reach everybody, but I think, you know, with that sort of, with the people who are informed, and with our media these days, people get informed pretty well. I think you deter some people. It may not be worth the price to society that you're going to pay for deterring them, but I think that deterrent argument's got a lot of merit to it. And I think, you know, if you say, oh, well, you know, most people aren't going to care because it's a crime, you know, they don't think about it or something. Maybe, might be right in a few cases, but I, you know, if somebody's, if you look at a lot of the domestic violence cases and stuff like that, where, you know, where a lot of these things build up for, you know, you think about them for a long time before you actually do it, I got to think you'd prevent a few, maybe quite a few.
We have one attorney here, doesn't practice criminal law.
Yeah, I was just thinking, as Dave said that the old bromide of the pickpocket was a capital offense in ancient, or not even ancient, 200-300 years ago in Europe, and the number of pockets that were picked at the time of the execution. We're going to see this way, the behavior
I think the deterrence argument has really been pretty well invalidated by most studies that I've seen. In terms of capital crimes, it could well have much greater significance with lesser offenses, obviously.
There have been a number of studies of states with capital punishment with similar demographics with states without, and no significant difference. You know.
Then what kind of a punishment are you going to propose for them? I mean, you talk to any jail, any kind of a prison warden, and they're going to tell you the last thing they want is somebody who's sentenced to life in prison with no possibility for parole. I mean, it's a license for them to do anything they want because they've already gotten the worst. If that's the worst punishment, you know, what are you going to do to me? So what are you going to do? And if you're going to let them out, if you're going to give them the possibility of parole, how are you going to tell that to the families of the victims or to society itself? You know, who sees that, you know, criminals come out of jail and go right back in for the next crime?
Let some other people jump in.
No, I don't really know anything about the average person that's on, death row. But it seems to me like the majority of them are probably pretty sick people. And I don't know, I guess that, I don't know what would deter them from being sick people. I don't know. It seems like there's something else that,
well, one thing we haven't talked about yet, and maybe that's part of what capital punishment does for us, and that's kind of the revenge factor. And maybe we'd like to talk about that for a little bit, about how kind of we feel a little bit of revenge towards Ted Bundy and kind of feeling like he got what he deserved. And that kind of seems, in some ways, to be the reason why we have capital punishment, at least in my mind. It's not to reform or to deter anyone as much as to give us a better feeling about the hideous things that have happened.
I don't know how much respect I have for human life, how Ted Bundy, or a person like Ted Bundy, when I see that he has no respect for human life itself. I think that's one of a big part of it. And also, how much respect do we give to human life itself and the lives of people who don't respect it themselves? And also, I was wondering if that $6.5 million is accurate as an average figure for.
I would tend to think it would be a lot less because of Bundy, because there were so many appeals and just this year alone. But he had an appeal last year, and 2 years ago, or 3 years ago. So I would say his is probably much higher.
Yeah, I was always under the assumption that capital punishment would be saving.
No, it's still very expensive. It's not that expensive.
Is it more expensive than keeping them in prison or trying to reform them?
Yeah, it is. It's almost always 3 to 4 times more than a life sentence. And Ted Bundy's was, 6 times, 10 times more? What I read.
I think I read, I may be very wrong, but somebody else might have read this as well, that Florida spent, I think, $26 or $27 million executing the 8 people that they've executed since 77 when the death penalty was reissued. So,
yeah, and it costs about $1 million to keep them in prison for life.
Well, you can calculate that by life expectancy, and I think the average cost for that type of prisoner would run 30 $30,000 to $40,000 a year. So figure your life expectancy of Ben Bundy probably 35 years, and you can determine what it would cost to keep him.
Isn't keeping him somewhat of a just an extended period on death row? I mean, having him in prison, he will eventually die. Never really.
We're all of them.
I, as when you were talking about respect for life, that, see, that to me, I mean, obviously this man, there's something in his system that is either a response to the state of our society or a response to some really major imbalance. And I don't see how we can compare his so-called respect for life with you know, the rest of humanity's respect for life. I mean, there, I'm sure that there were tons of studies on him before they actually killed him, but it just seems like there's obviously something wrong here if we have to seek this alternative to, it just seems really insane to me.
Yeah, and it seems like a particularly bad incongruity to say, well, since you didn't respect life, we're not going to respect yours either. And I think of what kind of a signal that gives to the people in our society, especially children, when they think of how do I deal with a problem. And here the authorities and the whole societal outlook is, well, kill them.
Well, I suspect that that hits on the revenge that you were asking about, Kirk, and I think it was real evident with popular media that people were just waiting for the execution to flip the switch. And, you know, it's true. When you simply think about lives in the balance, and you think about Bundy as a person who has committed this, maybe the cynical or the cast off approach is to say, well, he got it. You know, eventually what went round came round for him. And I think you're right. I think that element of revenge is kind of insidious. I would hope, though, that when people are evaluating punishment for the crime or whatever, whether it's punishment, whether it's reform, whether it's reparation, that they're not looking at revenge as a motivation for prescribing any of those. I think primarily our judicial system is set up that way. But then the issue becomes, is capital punishment solely based on revenge?
Certainly it is. I mean, you're not going to rehabilitate him if you execute him.
Right.
What are you doing it for, then?
Can you say that you're protecting society at large?
You could, if he's locked up in jail for the life, he's still protecting society.
If he escapes.
Well,
you know.
I mean, that's always a possibility.
That's always possible.
I mean, it doesn't happen very often.
Bundy did escape.
He
escaped from a school prison in Colorado.
Before he killed the 7-year-old girl.
He escaped twice, and that's the argument that is really the most persuasive argument, that a number of deaths occurred after the escape.
Mm-hmm.
And
the sorority murder, some of the most hideous ones actually occurred after that. But,
so I think revenge is kind of a two-edged sword here. I mean, we can say that quite distinctly that sure, the American public, or to a large extent, the media public, I like that word actually, the media public said, revenge, yeah, it's very suitable here. But on the other hand, let's take a look at the guy's record. And maybe we can say that his execution was fairly clearly a protective measure for society. I think that's also fairly clear too, because the man was obviously a serial killer, and because he escaped and then killed again. Now, I think, I'd kind of like to put the revenge issue aside for a moment and just say, based on the man's record, was that really an appropriate protective measure against society?
Do you think the people that were, for example, the people that were outside the prison celebrating the execution, I wonder if they were out there celebrating the protection of society.
I don't think so.
Many of the interviews that were in the PI of the parents of many of the women that were killed out here in Washington, in some ways I don't think many of them even had the public interest in mind. I really think revenge was everybody's motive. I'm not saying that I wouldn't feel that if it was my daughter that was killed, but I don't think many people were thinking that we're protecting other people from being killed by killing Ted Bundy.
I entirely agree with you, and you're right. I have a feeling the people that were celebrating were not thinking about, yay, society is safe again. Mm-hmm. I think they were saying, yay, he got what he was coming his way. But what I propose to look at is that, is what happened to Ted Bundy, based on the present judicial system that we have, was that based solely on revenge, or was it based on protection of society? Sure, people's response was a very vengeful response.
Well, if you take the protection for society argument, let's say that out of every 20 people you execute, two of them are mistakes. The other 18, they really were murderers.
Right.
Are you willing to pay that sort of 20% penalty to protect society?
I think that argument is interesting from an academic standpoint, but it just pragmatically, that just plain won't hold up. You might cite Sacco and Vanzetti, and that was a political thing. I know of no case in recent history where there's been even a scintilla of evidence that a murderer or a capital criminal was convicted. The Rosenbergs, maybe, again, in a political case. But you can't, from Carol Chessman on, you can't cite, I don't think you can cite anybody in the last 100 years in our system who's been wrongfully convicted and executed. I don't think it's happened.
You might be able to argue, though, that if we had more capital punishment, that cases like the Rosenbergs, I think, would probably be more prevalent, wouldn't they? Or I think it's.
Well, that's a really unique World War II type espionage situation that.
But I think the emotion, I guess it is unique in some ways, but I think it's also, it's a possibility to develop that kind of emotion around, I think Ted Bundy's case would be an excellent example of the emotion that can be created around.
Well, recently we've had the Walker case that's involved, it set us back, I guess, 20 years and destroyed codes that were really valuable to our national security. And we had capital punishment throughout the country, most states of the country, and yet these folks were given long-term prison sentences. And that's been true of all the recent espionage cases.
I stand corrected. That's what happens when you try to argue something you really don't know.
I'm opposed to it. The strongest argument in favor of it, of course, this is just an interesting academic discussion here, but you go out on Main Street and forget Holden Village, and you find a tremendous groundswell of sentiment, and I don't care, Mark, how you phrase the question, if you phrase it in terms of $6 million to execute, all the John Q. Public's going to tell you is, well, let's cut that, let's cut out the safeguards, and we'll do it a lot cheaper. I'm firmly convinced that the vast, it's probably 80% or better now, people favoring this punishment for certain criminals. And those particularly would be those who commit the crime of murder in a prison where there aren't many additional punishments. The killing of police officers arouses tremendous passion. And there are two or three others, maybe treason and some of the highest crimes of that kind. But there's not much question that the public supports it, and we are a democracy. And the only thing that limits what the public can legislate is what's in the Constitution. The Constitution is the limiting force. The only provision of the Constitution that would play upon this is the old saw of cruel and unusual punishment in what article, chapter, is that Article 4?
Wouldn't due process of law also?
No, I don't, but the point I'm making, Mark, is that the Supreme Court has had no difficulty with either one of those arguments throughout our 200 years of history. They've just been knocked down without any question at all, the United States Supreme Court. So the U.S. Supreme Court has left it up to the states, and the states are going to legislate by our representatives, and our representatives are going to respond to public pressure, and public pressure clearly is in favor of this. Again, I oppose it for reasons that have been expressed and some others, but I think the strongest argument for it is that the public is clearly in favor of it in this country today.
Yeah, but one thing I think that maybe you didn't mean to say this, or at least I would disagree with you on one point, and that is that did not the Supreme Court, when it halted capital punishment for a time, I forgot the name of the case for that.
I don't recall it either.
And that when it came together again in the early 70s, and then eventually voted to allow capital punishment under certain very strict guidelines, it came very close, at least according to some of the inside accounts that I've read, to going the other direction, that because of the irregular nature of the application of the penalty, that even though the great majority of people wanted a due process of law and cruel and unusual punishment were being violated, and they were using things like the statistical arguments. Now, we now have members on the court who will not use the statistical arguments, not only will not use it in capital punishment, but won't use it in discrimination and a variety of other things. And so that it's not as if it's been an easy decision on the court's part. We came very close to having it outlawed, but we had it actually halted for a time. Now we're moving the other direction.
The reason for the problem was that the imposition was so vastly divergent, state to state, and the tests that juries were applying were tests that were wholly inappropriate, and also the voir dire examination of jurors. Can you ask a juror in voir dire when you impanel a jury? Do you have a conscientious objection to the imposition of this punishment? And questions of that kind. So you were getting hanging juries and what have you. So there were a lot of technical reasons that all came together that prevented these executions from being carried out for a number of years. Then the legislatures went back and polished their acts and got their acts consistent with the dictates of the United States Supreme Court. And now the U.S. Supreme Court has said in most instances that those acts of state legislatures are constitutional. And that's where we are today.
Yep. Mm-hmm. But the statistical argument was part of it. It was not merely the impaneling of juries and other, because that was the NCAAP argument, I think of Georgia. But that one is the one area where they backed off from the position that they had enunciated earlier. It is true that the legislatures have now cleaned up their act in all the other areas, and occasionally the Supreme Court will strike down a statute because it doesn't meet all the criteria.
And the legislature will then go back to
and fix it.
Fix the statute, right.
But the statistical argument was one which now they're not using, which was one that they were entertaining earlier.
Yes.
Seems to me the very pragmatic approach from the general public is, notwithstanding all this deals in the courts and so on, is that whenever we see these terrible crimes, we see it being repetitive. The people have done it time and again. And for whatever reason, I think that's building up the public support, because they're saying it doesn't work what we're doing. Either we're not willing to pay for the cost of capital punishment, we're not willing to pay for the cost of prison, we're not willing to pay for the cost of education. So we have these repetitive crimes, and I think from a pragmatic point of view, people are just saying they're afraid and they're tending to support something different, whether they're right or not. I don't like to see capital punishment, but that's the way the opinion is going.
I still think, though, that the primary reason is revenge, because if it was for the protection of society, why aren't those same people or society willing to spend money on preventative measures? For example, handgun control laws. Currently, or in 1984, I think it was, Japan had 5 murders by handgun. Canada had 11. Great Britain had 15. And the United States had 11,000. Okay, now we talk about protection of society. Why don't we do some preventative stuff? So to my mind, it's still got to be some kind of revenge idea behind our support for capital punishment. Because we're not willing to do more preventative protective measures.
The other thing with that, instead of just saying revenge, it's sometimes putting it behind you as well. You think of guys like Richard Speck or Sirhan Sirhan, which every couple of years comes up for parole, and the same kind of hurts get open with victims, parents, and friends, and what have you. And you have that time and time again. Sometimes it almost makes you think that, you know, sure, capital punishment's not the answer, but maybe, you know, you could combine two of the worst problems, most divisive, and situate a special prison for these kind of heinous criminals over a toxic waste dump, so that you have this limited lifespan.
That would be cruel and unusual punishment. Well,
I guess I have to disagree with Bill on one thing. I think that deep down, well, I won't deny that there's a revenge factor, and that the Bundy folks were cheering like a football crowd, you know, in a big rival game or something. But I think that if you really looked at it carefully, whatever the public may want, the public would be very satisfied, and I think actually wants to be safe. I think the public wants to know that they are protected, that their families are protected, and that, you know, every effort has been made to make sure that their little boy or girl is not going to get murdered next week. And, you know, so you know, whether you're for or against capital punishment or something, I think you have to be able to look at, you know, how am I going to keep this person? This person has committed one crime. We've identified this person. We've convicted this person. How are we going to make sure this person never commits another crime? I mean, never commits this crime again. And until we find some way of, you know, addressing it, that sort of a thing, you know, you can put them in jail for a long time and you know, and make the other prisoners the ones who take the risks for it. Maybe by being convicted, they deserve those risks. But if I was in jail for tax fraud, I think I'd have a little, you know, I mean, obviously we segregate people, but I think you might have some people who were convicted of lesser crimes who'd have an objection to having a murderer next door, particularly if you're not going to let them back out on the street. If you're going to let them back out on the street, I think you're going to have a tough time convincing people that they really were rehabilitated and didn't just read the right psychological books to know how to pass their, you know, convince their parole officer that they were okay again so they can get back out there. You know, maybe medical science will come up with some way that we can, you know, physically ensure that this person isn't going to go out and commit another murder. But then you've got a lot of invasion of privacy, right? I mean, somewhere along the line, I think society is saying with the death penalty, we want to be protected. And maybe I'll challenge you, if you're going to say don't go for the death penalty, maybe the constructive thing is to come up with something else. You know, how are you going to tell society, at least beyond your statistical probability, you know, you're as protected as we're willing to make you?
Well, for one thing, we already know that it doesn't deter. Having killing people doesn't create fewer murders, for one thing. And also, we know that the U.S., without handgun laws and with the death penalty, has many more times murders than countries without death penalty and with handgun laws, for instance, as one case. I mean, we know that, or the people should. So I think they either are uninformed or they're still basically working out of a motive of revenge, because all our examples that we have to study show us just the opposite of what you're claiming people really believe.
I agree that the handgun law would probably go miles and miles and miles toward doing that. You know, if this was a handgun form, you know, that I think, you know, we could probably go a long way toward that. I guess, you know, but on the other hand, I'll also tell you that I've sat enough committee meetings and, you know, budgetary meetings and everything else, and trying to get anybody to prevent anything is like pulling teeth. For some reason, American society really never, I've never run into a group that really thinks in terms of prevention, you know. And I don't know why that is. But if you try to convince...
You don't want to debate everybody's own personal rights. Sort of like Holman Village as a community. What can we decide to do on as a group? We're very independent.
Also, I think there is this notion that we can't adequately safeguard our society against itself, which, if you kind of look at that, it's kind of a bogus notion. That's why, you know, I made the kind of flip comment about Ted Bundy saying that, well, you know, you lock him up in prison, is that really safeguarding him from society? He could escape. I think protectionism can be taken to a point of fanaticism, saying that we're going to do everything within our power to put up all the security systems and all the bars and all the locks and all the guards and kill all the criminals that we possibly can to keep us safe. And maybe this goes back to what you're talking about, Dave, that simply is part of the media mentality of our that right now we are feeling so vulnerable individually that we feel that there are certain punishments that need to be prescribed in order to reach some level of protection. And maybe that's the issue that needs to be addressed, is that, you know, what is protecting society? What does that really mean?
We've talked a lot about statistics and about how the public feels and things like that. I guess when I think about capital punishment, one of the first things that comes to my mind is, do I have a right to have my society do something that I would not do myself? In other words, if I would not be willing to throw a switch, pull the trigger, etc., and I'm not, do I have a right to say that the society should do it for me? It's a little more personal and disgusting statistics.
I think this culture is really messed up, but that's beside the point. That part of the whole issue of this entertainment thing, that it's being like a football game, that basically everyone is really scared, and so they're going to try their hardest to find other things to occupy their attention or their lives or their families' lives. And I think that's, you know, we have to be entertained with something besides fiction, besides movies. So we have to have
some element of reality in how we entertain. I mean, it seems so insane to me that that's the only way I can rationalize why. You know, I mean, if I can think of discussions I've had with people and the response of this mentality of, I'm going to get my case of beer and I'm going to sit and watch this thing. I mean, it's really consistent. I mean, I experienced that in many other instances as well, and I don't, you know, and I, how do you even begin? The big question I have, I guess, is how do you begin to approach someone and say, you know, what, why is this, why do you find such satisfaction in this? Where is your own fear that makes this, or feels, I don't know, it just seems so crazy. I mean, we need like this mass, you know, we need some giant therapist to come out from the sky. And it's just so insane. I mean, it's all become a game, basically.
I'd sort of like to challenge the notion that our jails and our incarceration system is not cruel and unusual punishment. In some ways, I think it's almost worse than death. Because, I mean, our jails are just breeding grounds for crime. You go into jail, you become the victim of crime, or you commit crimes in order to survive. And in some ways, it might be better to die than be put into that sort of a situation.
Yeah, there's an interesting book that was written a few years ago called In the Belly of the Beast. And it's a book about one criminal's experience in prison. And you read that book, and you get this impression that an entirely new species has been created. It's a horrible thing. And an opinion of mine is simply this, is that I feel that it is just as sinful, just as morally wrong to kill a person as it is to completely control a segment of that person's life, whether it's for to completely deny a person for a segment of their life, and especially if that leads to that. And you know, it seems obvious that when in our present penal system, when we incarcerate a person without, and you know, there's all this talk about rehabilitation. When I read In the Belly of the Beast, I begin to wonder just what that rehabilitation really is doing. I find that to be just as morally heinous, just as sinfully repugnant, and just as evil. So when we talk about capital punishment, I can't help but associate that with our entire penal system. And as crazy as it is, and I agree, it you look at it and you think, yuck, there's something really messed up. I think the only way that we can begin to make something effective, is to try to learn more about it, is to try to understand the history of it and sometimes how it works. I think one thing that is kind of problematic right now is the fact that it is such a big economic drain. I recently found out that, you may know more about this, Paul, than I do, that the defense attorneys in Washington State, there's a certain fund that is used to pay for defense attorneys when people who are accused of a crime don't have any money to pay for a defense attorney. That fund is nearly dropped. Nearly gone. What does that say about this tremendous load on our judicial system? It's a real complex issue. It's a dreadfully complex issue, and I think the worst thing that we can do is try to run away from it. Is to try to say it's so crazy that I just don't want to deal with it anymore.
I'm not saying that. Don't imply that I'm saying that at all. I think we're talking about a lot more than just the death penalty. So that becomes more overwhelming. I'm not at all in favor of saying, well,
it didn't. No, I don't mean to say that you sounded fatalistic. but I think oftentimes when we get caught up in that craziness, it gives us a real opportunity to say, I don't want to deal with it anymore. I want to go home and drink some hot chocolate.
I mean, I'd go as far as to say, that I think our school system is a form of a death penalty. But, you know, there's plenty of that going on around. There's a lot of parallels with teaching people how to be dead or teaching people how to be numb.
Spend an hour. Go longer.
I'm not sure I understand what the religious rights kind of argument is for it. Can anybody help me on that? Because I think there is a large segment.
For Captain?
Mm-hmm. Would it be more out of the Old Testament? That would be my guess, but that's all it would be.
It's something you could easily write away to some of the organizations, and they'd be glad to send the yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting to see what. At least then next time you have a forum on it, yeah, you could hand it out and have people study up.
Terry was saying, as we were talking, it's at a snack bar, it's kind of interesting that there's a large segment, I suppose, of religious people even that are for the death penalty, but vehemently opposed to the to abortion. I guess on the flip side of that, though, there's a large segment that's against the death penalty, but for abortion.
Yep. I mean, when they say they're opposed to the killing of innocent life.
Right.
Yeah. That's the operative word.
Innocent. I don't know what they would claim as their justification to support the death penalty, but I suspect that, personally, I suspect that it comes from an attitude of thinking that because they are involved in the religious community in this specific particular way, that they are kind of better than the general populace, and so they kind of have an attitude of intolerance, even among themselves. As soon as somebody goofs up in one certain way, I mean, everything breaks loose, like, for instance, Jimmy Swagger and stuff. So I suspect fundamentally it comes from their religious perspective of the very black and white issues and very easily determined right and wrong. And once something is determined wrong, then it should, you know, just be blotted out completely. So
I think another argument when I was looking around for those kinds of arguments that one that was sort of vaguely described to me from the Old Testament had to do with the 40 years in the wilderness and some of the practices that grew up in, and not being a biblical scholar, I don't know what those were, but some of the standard punishments that were dealt out in those times as a wandering people, kind of keep the people of God in line, and I guess some groups would use those as a sort of extend those to present day society. Apparently there was a number of capital punishments for a variety of crimes, probably again close to our African, you know, sort of example of, you know, if you have a crime against society that society's decided it doesn't want to have, put death penalty on.
Well, I'm tired. But I skied today, so. Maybe we should call it a day.
Thanks.